Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson, your friends of financial education. Back for another week. How you doing, Ryan?
Good, man. Financial education, trust, asset protection, tax planning, financial everything brought to you live. Well, maybe not live. Pre-recorded. And aired.
From last week.
Yeah, generally on like Tuesdays or Wednesdays, but that's been sliding around a little bit. We've been busy, but hey, we have a great, outstanding guest today. And if you're just like wondering how to unpack the difference between a will, a trust, a revocable, irrevocable, why it should matter, I don't care. How do I give money to my kids? How do I not give money to my kids? How do I give money to my kids when certain milestones are met? How do I manage all of this wealth that I'm creating as a pilot or as a real estate investor or an investor in general? This is the show that you have to listen to today. Tate, who do we have?
We have, for the third time, Adam Kinte from Nevada Corporate Headquarters. I'm personally working with Adam and the team over there to set up my entity structure, my trust, everything. And I got to say, they're great. We had Adam on for the first time back in July, episode 119. We talked about LLCs, trusts, and bulletproof asset protection, sort of like piercing the corporate veil and how to protect your assets. We had him back on episode 127, talking more about LLCs, trusts, K-1s, asset protection, but we really wanted to have him back just to talk about the revocable living trust, sort of the centerpiece of your estate plan, which is your family trust, and how to put your assets into it, how to create it, how to talk through all of the different provisions of where your money goes after you get hit by a bus, God forbid. It's really, really important. Really important.
It is. And we don't know when life is precious. We don't know when our last day is here, right? So you may think, oh, I'm not going to die for a while. I've got plenty of time. You need to run and you need to set up your trust, right? We're not giving you tax, legal, or investment advice, but we're just talking here as friends. Get your trust set up so you have it. And I think the other thing is that when you die, there's going to be a lot of people that try to come after your stuff. And we're going to talk today, too, about how the trust can protect you from these creditors that will come and try to take your heirs' stuff, like your kids or whoever you give your stuff to, right? So I'm really excited to get into it.
Even people that aren't entitled to it.
Yeah.
Like people that just say like, hey, I'm his kid, too.
Right.
Which is crazy.
Before we get into it, I just want to say, too, we do have a YouTube channel. You can go watch Tate and I and the guest on our YouTube channel, like and subscribe. We would love you to get on there, write a review or just comment if you like it. That's kind of a nice quick way to say, hey, I really like this guy. Bring more of that or have more of this guest or hey, you know, I mean, if you have a bad comment, don't leave that. Just email us or something. But no, just, to, you know, hey, if you like our content, leave a comment. We go in there every once in a while, read the comments. And you'll also see something really important. Our guest today is wearing a Passive Income Pilots shirt that says retired on it as well. Yeah, which by the way, we don't have merchandise or swag. He just
which is awesome. We have no idea where he got this.
Yeah, we have no idea where he got the swag.
So Adam is in the Facebook group. If you're not part of the Facebook group, join it. We've got Nathan Sosa from Hall CPA on there. You can tag at Nathan if you've got tax questions. You can also tag Adam Kinte if you have asset protection or trust questions. It's great. It's an open forum. But you know how he got this shirt? He's part of the Facebook group, right? And there's those ads that like scrape the name of your group. And it says like, hey, do you want to buy this shirt that says Passive Income? So he said, sure. And he clicked the link. So this is hilarious. This is the first like official Passive Income Pilot swag that we've seen. It's just from like, I don't know, some Laotian company.
Yeah. Yeah. We did not get any royalties. We did not get paid. There's no profit. But it is really funny. But anyway, yeah, that's a good point about the Facebook group. I mean, guys, we have these experts that come on and talk about this stuff in a Facebook group that you could go ask questions directly to. We cut out the middleman, right? So join our Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots. Make sure you say who you are. There's been a lot of weird, scammy things going on in that Facebook group. Yeah, tell us what airline you work at. We're not like keeping record of that stuff, but we just want to make sure that people are coming in. They're actual airline pilots.
Exactly. We're not trying to gatekeep too hard, but if you don't answer the questions, we're not going to let you in because there's always a, you know, somebody's account that got hacked or, you know, we're trying to keep it spam free.
Absolutely. Well, with that, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators.
we interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Adam Kinte, thank you so much for coming back on the show. We're excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about revocable living trusts today. I think that that is an absolutely critical piece of everyone's estate planning and financial planning toolbox. If you haven't already listened to the episode 114 with Amanda Winalda, go back, listen to that. That's the basics of trusts. So if you want to understand from a kindergarten level what a trust is, go back to that episode with Amanda. Check it out. We've also had Adam on the show twice now talking about LLCs, asset protection. Those are fantastic episodes. Highly recommend you go back and listen to those. But today, we're just going to be focusing on the revocable living trust. So Adam, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, the first question I always usually get is what's the difference between a will and a trust? And I know people can go back and listen to those other episodes, but can we kind of set the stage? I think pilots tend to say things like, well, I can get a free will through my health insurance plan or whatever, my benefits at the airline. But what's the trust part of it? And I think this is probably one of the most neglected things people have in their asset protection strategy. So can you kind of just set the stage with that real quick?
Yeah, and that is the most often question I get is, should we have a trust or should we have a will? And the answer is you need both. If God forbid anything were to happen and you have nothing in place, or if you only have a will, what that means is everything will go through probate. And probate is very expensive and very time consuming. And think about your loved ones, your significant other, your children, or whoever you're leaving stuff to. Any titled asset you have in your name, it will go through probate. And it will cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And it can be years, depending on where you live. The probate courts, it can take years to change an asset from you to your heirs. So the trust is so important. It does two things. One, it avoids probate. Two, if we name it correctly, it provides financial privacy as well, right? So, but there's no asset protection for it.
And for somebody who doesn't know what probate is, what is that and when does it happen?
Yeah, so probate is when you die, everything goes into probate. Probate's a Latin word meaning prove up, where your heirs have to come and prove that they're the rightful beneficiary of your house or your car, anything that has a title on it. That is probate. Probate's this court, and there is probate attorneys that make a lot of money. It was back in 2009, one of our attorneys, Steve, he had a lady that had no heirs, and she wanted to leave all her assets to the ASPCA. She loved animals, a very wealthy woman, and she got all the trust done, did her trust work, and Steve said, all right, now you got the trust done. We got to put something in it so that we have activated the trust. And so here's a deed to put your house in there. Go record that, and your trust will be active. She never did it. She died. Our attorney, Steve, he made so much money that, of course, because he did the will, the courts called on him to do the probate work. And he made so much money off that one case. Took him a couple years in probate courts, but he made enough money that he bought the nicest house on a golf course here in Vegas and paid cash. That's how much money was involved with this when dealing with probate. So that probate is just a special court to make sure that your stuff actually goes to your kids or your spouse or whoever you've left stuff to. And that's just the process that he goes through, is the probate court.
I can't tell you how often I hear this where people say, oh, I need an LLC to save taxes. It's like, an LLC doesn't save you taxes. Oh, I need a trust. I need a will. But then they don't do anything with it. They start an LLC, they don't put a property into it. They don't start a bank account for the LLC. It's just a shell that's sitting there empty off to the side. And if you were ever to get sued, it's going to offer absolutely no asset protection because you weren't treating it like a real company. A trust is exactly the same way. I hear about this all the time. In fact, my parents, God bless them, started a trust and then forgot about it, didn't do anything with it, and they're still in the process of moving assets into it. So very important that you activate it.
Yeah, when we're doing an estate plan, we still have a will, last will and testament. That covers morbid things, like if I die, I don't want to be cremated. Medical directives, financial directives, medical power of attorney, financial power of attorney. If you have children, so you know, I'm married, I have six boys, and normally when a child turns 18, or if they're above 18 and you die, they are getting whatever inheritance they're due. And in my case, my oldest is 25, the youngest is 15, and if they got any amount of money, they would blow it immediately. So we do have, if you have minor children, we have child care directives in case something happens on date night. Who do you want to have guardianship of the kids? But the spendthrift provisions, spend just like spending money, spendthrift provisions that I put in mind, that the kids get nothing when they're 18. The trust says we are only going to pay for college or trade school and basic living expenses up to the age of 25. If they choose not to go to college or trade school, that's fine. They're not getting a dime until they're 25. They'll get a chunk of money. I put the second chunk at 30 and then the last chunk at 40. And our thought process is they might blow it once. They might blow it twice. We sure hope they don't blow it three times. The trust says if they have any financial duress, if they're going through a bankruptcy or a divorce or any financial duress, they cannot receive a dime until their problems are gone. So that just protects them from their inheritance. The trust itself is just some paperwork. It's a trust is a contract between you and your beneficiaries. And in the trust, we want to make sure we normally will title your primary residence. I like to add your personal checking account, savings account, give a brokerage account, membership of your LLCs. Think of that trust as a basket that we're just going to put stuff in that basket. We're going to put the deed for your house, things of that nature. Your titled assets we put into that trust. And then we always do a pour over will. And just like pouring a glass of water, anything you forgot to put in the trust or chose not to put in the trust goes in the trust when you die. And that's meant as a catch-all for things like vehicles. So if you have a car, truck, boat, trailer, we just leave that stuff in your name. You know, that's covered by the pour-over will. And then we also, you know, a couple of things that we always make sure of. We have provisions for cryptocurrency. That's always a good thing. And we talked about the fact that a trust does not provide asset protection. But recently, we started putting some provisions in there. It's called right to return provisions. So as we get older, you know, most people don't have long-term care insurance. And oftentimes when they do, it's just not enough. So say I died and my wife has to go into a nursing home or a long-term care facility. Well, the government's going to pay for it. But as soon as she's out of that house for 30 to 60 days, the state can foreclose on the property to pay whatever medical bills she's racking up. Not with this trust, with the provisions we put in there, the government can never take that house. And the trust says that upon your death, your beneficiaries may, that keyword may, choose to pay your unsecured debt. But they have no duty and no obligation to pay any unsecured creditor when you die. So I think that's like a really important thing that most people don't think about. But that's the pieces for that estate plan that needs to be done. And this is what's called a revocable trust, R-E-V-O, revocable. And then there's also irrevocable. And that's important for people to understand. Very rare do I do an irrevocable trust.
Adam just dropped a ton of knowledge. And we need to go back and just like make sure everybody's kind of tracking what Adam just dropped on us, right? Two things that you really did. You talked about the trust kind of being like a kind of a financial roadmap for how you want to provide to your kids, right? And let's talk about that for a minute. But also you talked about how this is going to protect your wealth when you pass, if there's creditors and things like that. So two massive things before we get into revocable and irrevocable. The one thing I wanted to really pull on was the first thing, which is you told the story about how you made this a roadmap for what your kids get. And guess what? A lot of pilots that are listening to this right now, they're making big money all of a sudden. They're making $500, $1 million a year. They're putting lots of money in their 401k. They are going to have kind of big nest eggs when they pass away. And I know as parents, we think about how do we want to really transfer wealth to our children? Right? That's a big thing. Like, do we want to just give them stuff or do we want them to earn it? Do we want them to wait to a certain age? Do we want them to get all of it, get none of it, get some of it, right? How do we think about how it transfers to their children? And here's a story that I think is really interesting. Very high net worth person that I know kind of walked me through some of the stories about their trust. And they make it so their kids, if they get married to somebody, right, they actually have to sign a prenuptial agreement to participate in his trust, right? So imagine you have a daughter, she goes, gets married, you have a ton of money, you have a daughter, she goes, gets married, you pass away, she gets all your money, and then he takes it and gets divorced, right? Or vice versa. So there's all kinds of things that you can think through in your flight plan on your trust. And when you put it in there, it becomes ironclad. And to tie that together with the probate side of it, this is so important because when you die, as Adam suggests, you go to probate. And if there is no trust, good luck, because all the attorneys are going to do, they're going to fight over all the things that you have. Everybody's going to get emotional. Yep. It's going to tear the family to shreds, right? So your trust is like this roadmap of what you want to leave your kids. And if you don't have kids, what you want to leave your estate to your charities or to organizations that you're passionate about, please go get a trust. Make sure you have your roadmap.
Absolutely. So well said, Ryan.
Yeah. And just like, don't let this stuff sort of unravel when you pass away. You've earned it. You've made good money. You have a great retirement. Don't let this go away, right?
Absolutely.
Because you're going to just spend lots of money on attorneys fighting this, right? And your kids, oh, God forbid, your kids are going to be fighting over it, right? And then once you get this all in place, share it with your family. Tell your family what's in your trust. Say, hey, this is how I think about, you know, this or that, or have a family meeting and talk about these things with your kids so that they're in the loop, right? And maybe at 5 years old, it's not appropriate, or 8 years old or whatever it is. But at some point, you know, then they're thinking about how they're going to roadmap their future, right? So there's a lot of stuff we could probably talk for hours about. How do we give wealth to the next generation? Do we want to just give it away? Will that ruin them? Because I know a lot of pilots that listen to this, they're gritty. They paid for their own flight school, paid for their own college. They hustled through, they slung gear at a regional for $18,000 a year. Yep. They've earned it, right? And so now your kids are not going to have the same upbringing, the same grittiness that you went through, and they're just handed wealth. And that might not be how you want to do it. Well, that's a great conversation, but the way you actually roadmap it is through a trust. So come to the table kind of with some of those things. And then the other thing you talked about, I thought was so...
Here, Ryan, before you, let me pass the ball a little bit on this, because I really want to unpack that. So Adam, I have two questions here related to this. And I love how you put that, Ryan. How many pages is your trust, Adam? And how is it structured? And then a tack on question to that will be, how do you approach this conversation when you're planning?
It's many pages.
Many pages.
A good inch and a half, 2 inches thick worth of stuff. But something I thought was really interesting is I was teaching a class a few weeks ago, and we were in Louisville, Kentucky. And this lady had come in, and her church said, well, if you leave 5% of your estate to the church, they will do a trust for you for free. And my attorney was there at this event. We were doing a workshop, and I said, well, Kurt, take a look at this and see what you think. And normally Kurt looks through it and he gives me advice and feedback about good or not good. And he looked at this one, he said, Adam, it's good in a sense that it's a trust. It is a terrible trust. There are so many things that are left out of this that need to be addressed. So that free trust that they got done by leaving 5% was just an absolute terrible document. They are not all created equal. And that's why I always get worried when people have like legal insurance that they can use. What we don't know is they always contract with the law firm to get some work done. And I don't know if that attorney or the law firm, I don't know if they really know this stuff or not. I do know that all attorneys use software to do this stuff. You know, they plug these things in, and oftentimes the attorneys will have software that is very outdated, or it's real basic because they don't do very many of them. So they don't spend the money getting the best software. So that's something that's really important to me when I'm looking at trust. Will it avoid probate? It will. But there's so many things that need to be addressed in that trust. And that's why the trust get kind of thick, is addressing these little things that you don't think about. But that's what we pay that estate planning attorney to do. Make sure he thinks about the things that you have not thought about.
So it's an inch and a half thick. How's it structured? And how do you guide people through those conversations? Because that's a long conversation with your spouse to think through. You said that your kids get some money here, some money there, some money a third time. That's a lot of nuts and bolts, right? So how long did that take you to sit down and plan that all out with your spouse? How does that conversation unravel? Where do you start?
Yeah, that was a difficult conversation because with the six boys, they were young, we put this together. And who do we want to have guardianship of the kids? That was probably the longest part of the conversation. And then you're the trustee while you're alive. The trustee is in charge of everything. You're also the beneficiary while you're alive, and you're the grantor. You put stuff in there. Yeah, the grantor puts stuff in, and the trustee manages everything. And then you've got the beneficiaries receive it. Well, this is a revocable trust, meaning that you are the trustee and the grantor and the beneficiary while you're alive. You can change it whenever you want to, but you appoint a successor trustee. And the successor trustee's job is to follow that roadmap of where you want things to go and manage things on behalf of your children until they become of age where they get those things if they meet the roadmarks. And you could put all kinds of hoops in there. For example, I just put they don't get any money if they choose not to go to college or trade school. You could have a lot more detail in there where they have to have read a certain book or have a financial education course or whatever those things may be where you're setting these hoops up. If they don't get that done, they're not getting anything. And I love what you talked about, the grit, and a lot of people, they work very hard to get where they're at and just simply leaving these to kill children. I had this guy, $2.6 billion of real estate. He owned 1,400 LLCs in 23 different states. Very, very wealthy guy. And he had one child and he did not have an estate plan. And I said, understand that when you die, all this stuff is going to go into probate. It's going to be so expensive. And he said, Adam, I have ruined my son's life enough with money. If he ends up getting nothing, I'm okay with that. So these are things that we want to think about. But the conversation with you and your spouse or your significant other, it really needs to be, who do we want to be in charge of these things?
But Adam, just to kind of pull on that $2.6 billion guy, I mean, he doesn't want his son to have any more money. And so what would protect himself from that would be to make a trust. Because again, it's not that, oh, I don't want my kids to have any money, so I'm not going to put together a trust. Oh, no, no, no. When you die, your kids will argue over your money in court and they'll probably end up with some of it, right? The motivated ones will probably end up with some of it. So he's still not satisfying his objective to not give his son any more money.
Absolutely.
His trust would be the thing that would say, nope, it goes here, 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 and here, right? And it doesn't go to that guy, right? And that's why it's like, if you're listening to this, like, well, I don't want my kids to have any money anyway. I'm just not going to do anything. Well, guess what? You are, because they're getting, and I know this because I used to go buy real estate out of the probate court, right? I would go with people early on in my real estate career, and I would find these houses that were deeply in distress, and then they had back taxes owed, and then when I finally connected with the person that was sort of quote unquote in control, they didn't have any estate planning or will or anything like that. So we'd actually help them go through probate and sort of help them navigate these probate courts and then end up with a really heavily discounted piece of property. And it was wild, the people that came out of the woodwork. I'll never forget me and Scott going over to Bobo's house because Bobo found out that Angie had this thing going, and it was this crazy puzzle piece. And guess what? She lost money because of it, but she was the rightful. We did find some kind of wills and things like that, but it's like a mess. So if you don't do this, you create a mess for whoever you're giving it to. And again, attorneys are going to probably take half of it fighting, and then it's going to end up in all the wrong places. So anyway, I just wanted to, I think that just can't be understated, to pilots,
Yeah, you're right.
Love that.
The second thing, if we're ready to kind of move on, I mean, the protection that it gives you in your kids. So, you have all this nest egg. And then the second thing you were talking about is, okay, so you die. And then, this, all these assets transfer to somebody, but then you have these creditors coming after, you as a dead person now. And now that creditor could start to come after your children for the money, but the trust could have things in there that protects them from having to pay creditors. right? So that is massively important because, again, if you don't have a trust, let's say you're in the example of caring about where your money goes and your kid's getting it, this is like really important. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I think what you asked me to elaborate on is
The shall, the may.
Yeah, making sure that your unsecured creditors don't get your stuff, right? What's interesting is that you can have these rules of, you know, what they get and when they get it, but the trust becomes irrevocable when you die. It can't be changed. And if you just had a will, for example, a part of the probate process is you got to publish in the newspaper all of your stuff. All your assets get published in the newspaper where any creditor can come and say, oh, he owes me, or anybody could just come in and say, I get this or I get that. It could be anybody.
Can you give an example? I don't think a lot of pilots listening to this have creditors coming after them. So can you give an example of what that would look like if, you know, I passed away and who's coming after my stuff? Who are these creditors you're talking about? If a pilot's going, my mortgage is on autopilot, I got plenty of cash in the bank to cover it, you know, what? Who are these creditors?
Yeah, well, in the will process, it could be children. It could be that someone says they're your child. That happens. Or it could be a nursing home or a long-term care facility, or it could be any one of those things of people saying that you owe them money or that they're a beneficiary and they're a rightful heir. I think it was Prince. When Prince died, he died intestate, meaning he didn't have anything, and he had like 26 people that said they were his child. 26 people that contested it. And after all the DNA testing, no children. So, but those are the type of things that could come in, not necessarily the creditor being somebody you owe money to. Generally, that is a hospital or something of that nature, depending on how you passed. But those are typically the people that try and come after it.
Got it.
Or these people that just troll the obituaries and see, that guy's got a lot of stuff. Yeah, let's throw my name in the hat there. Nobody's fighting with it. There you go.
Yeah, don't make a mess of your family when you pass away and wrong money getting into wrong people's hands. Real quick, you just said something that I've never heard before, actually, which is when you die, the trust goes from a revocable trust to an irrevocable trust. And, you know, again, that's very basic. And now when you said it, it sort of clicked like, yes, once you die, then the thing can't change anymore. That's obvious. But then Tate asked a really great question earlier about what's the difference between revocable and irrevocable.
Exactly.
So can we transition into that?
Yeah. There are times where an irrevocable trust is relevant when you're alive. And right now, with the estate planning laws, you get $15 million that you can pass on to your heirs without any inheritance tax. Now, this is state specific. There are some states, like I think Oregon, for example, where Washington, when you die, the most states mirror the federal exemption amount, which is right now $15 million for you, $15 million for your spouse. As long as you're below that $15 million, it passes on and your family doesn't have to pay any taxes on it. If you're above that mark, then they have the inheritance tax, and federally, it's the 40%. So that can be a big number. So or a state like Oregon or Washington, where you're anything above $1 million, they're gonna have to pay 10% of the value of the estate goes to the state of Oregon when you die. So those are things that are always in consideration when doing estate planning. Is irrevocable. Right now, what I often will do is an irrevocable life insurance trust. So a revocable trust holds your house and your, you know, your LLCs and things of that nature. But then there's an irrevocable trust that I strategically use to remove the value of life insurance outside of your taxable estate. Hmm. So for example, I had a guy a few weeks ago that his estate value right now is at $18 million. And then he and his wife both have several life insurance policies. And with the investments that they're making, they're pretty quickly going to be above that $30 million mark. So we took that life insurance, and it was about $5 million of life insurance, and we moved that into an irrevocable trust so that $5 million, add that to his $18 million, he's already at $23 million. He's pretty quickly, in a few years, he'll be above 30. We took that $5 million and put it into an irrevocable trust just to remove the value of life insurance outside the taxable estate so that when he and his wife dies, well, there's $5 million that the kids are going to get to pay anything that's beyond the $30 million exclusion. So that's normally where I'll use an irrevocable trust, or I've got a lady in Texas who owns a lot of oil wells. She's very, very wealthy, and she has so much money. She has an irrevocable trust that is set up for generations to come.
Yeah, so you just said a lot there. So revocable means you can change it while you're living. Change it, change it, change it. You can change it every day, every month, every year. Don't drive your attorney too crazy, but you can change it, right? You can put things in, take things out, right? You can say, here's what I want for my kids, and say, ah, never mind, I didn't want that, right? You can say, I want to include all these things. Ah, I don't want to do that anymore, right? That's revocable. And so if you die with a revocable trust, you are going to be subject to some of these federal and state level taxes.
Estate taxes, right, if they're over the threshold.
Right, but the states might be specific to how much they charge you. Like if you live in some more blue states, they probably try to take more money. If you live in the red states, maybe it's a little bit better. Then you have an irrevocable trust, which means once you put it in there, you cannot change it. And those things are going to be exempt from taxes. But what are some of the downsides to that? Because,
and just to be clear, estate taxes when you die.
Right. Estate taxes. Correct.
Right. Because an irrevocable trust is like a multi-generational trust, right, Adam? It's something that it bridges generations.
Yep.
Yeah. And what would be some of the downsides to putting things in an irrevocable trust? Why wouldn't everyone just do that to avoid the estate tax? Right. Well, why wouldn't they do that? Yeah.
So there's rules involved with, one, you can't render yourself insolvent. I can't just stick all my stuff into an irrevocable trust and I render myself insolvent. There's some rules behind that. And there are types of trust. They call this it's an irrevocable, self-settled, spendthrift grantor trust that is intentionally defective for tax purpose. There's a lot of different trusts that are out there, but generally speaking, the revocable part of it moves stuff in and out. It does not file a separate tax return. Your social security number is used for anything you've got in that trust. There's no additional taxes, whereas an irrevocable trust has its own EIN number and is taxed at the trust tax rates, which are much higher.
Right.
I think if you're above $15 or $25 million that irrevocable trust gets, it's paying the highest tax rate at 37%. So it's very rare. If I put my house in there, for example, it's no longer my house. And technically, I've got to rent it from my beneficiaries if I were to do that. So we have to be very careful on irrevocable trust of what you put in there. If you had a family cabin, for example, that you want to make sure it doesn't get sold off, that stays in for generations, then you might consider an irrevocable trust.
I think what you said there is so important for people to wrap their heads around, because people forget that when you start an entity, let's say an LLC, let's just go back to an LLC, that LLC by default is a disregarded entity. So when you file a tax return, the IRS does not look at that LLC as a separate entity with its own EIN, employer identification, or TIN, tax identification number. They're the same things, a separate thing from you. It's going to flow through right onto your 1040. So it is a separate entity from asset protection standpoint, but it is not from a taxation standpoint. And that is the key between revocable and irrevocable trust. Is an irrevocable trust has its own EIN. It files its own tax return. It is purely separate from you. It owes its own taxes. It does not flow onto your 1040. Anything that is in your revocable trust, it is a disregarded entity for tax purposes. Everything flows through the trust onto your 1040. If you subscribe to a Turbine Capital deal or a Spartan deal, and you put it into your trust, you title it in your trust, which we have lots of investors which do that, and we can talk about whether that's a good idea or not. But it's their social that shows up, their name and social that shows up on the K-1. The trust is just down on the bottom listed. So, thoughts on that, Adam? Do you want to confirm or deny any of those statements?
You're 100% right. Your revocable trust, you get your investment through Turbine Capital, and they put that in your trust name. But when tax time rolls around, it gives you the K-1 with your trust name on it, and it just reports in your personal tax return exactly the same as if it was in your name. So So that's just a revocable trust. We can change it whenever we want to. It's us for tax purpose while we're alive, versus if I put it into an irrevocable trust, different ball game. Now it's got to file its own taxes. And again, usually it's much higher than you would pay individually. So it's, again, very strategically, when we use irrevocable trust, it's a strategic thing. And I rarely do those unless you have a big estate and you're a pretty wealthy person. Then we start looking at those things. But we want to be careful working with those irrevocable trusts. We also want to make sure we work with your CPA on these things, because once you do it, it can be undone, but it gets very expensive. So be very mindful about that.
Excellent. So most people are in the market for a revocable living trust. And keep in mind that the revocable living trust does not in itself provide asset protection. Now, I know we've already talked about this on the previous episodes, but it's probably worth recapping just briefly the difference in asset protection that an irrevocable trust provides versus a revocable trust. So a typical revocable living trust provides no asset protection. It's just a box that you can put things in that spells out that this passes on to the next generation just like this, whereas an irrevocable trust actually does provide some asset protection.
Correct. And here's where the key is. So in the terms of the asset protection, if you get sued personally and you get brought into a deposition, you got to list everything you own, your house, your cars, you own these LLCs. They also ask, are you the beneficiary of a trust? And if your answer is yes, because I am the beneficiary of my trust while I'm alive, then it can be taken. With an irrevocable trust, I'm not the beneficiary. So now I get brought into a deposition. I don't own any of that. That's its own thing. I am not the beneficiary. My kids are. And our attorney would argue, don't let your kids know certain things. So that if they do get sued and they ask the question, are you the beneficiary of a trust? They can say, nope. And they're not lying to you, because they really, they don't know what they're going to get, and et cetera. So our attorney argues that it's an excellent conversation to have with your kids, but sometimes there is a value in not spilling all the beans and telling them all of it. Instead, showing them that, here's where my trust is. So when I die, this is what's going to happen. I have so-and-so appointed as our trustee. You know, Uncle Gary is going to make sure you get your money when you're supposed to get it. And there you go. You know, that's kind of the limit of what I want my kids to know about. I don't want them to know all my stuff that I have, because that could present a problem in the future. I just talked to did this for my cousin, his father-in-law. $5 million estate, not a lot, but it's a lot for them in the Midwest. And he has his son is one of the beneficiaries and his daughter as the other beneficiary. And thank goodness we got this done, because the son and daughter hate each other, literally hate each other. So he's going to get some stuff and she's going to get some stuff. What they get is none of the other child's business. They will have no idea what the one child got and what the other one didn't get. They'll have no idea, because we've got that trust in place. Just make sure they get what they're supposed to get when they're supposed to get it. So little things that we put, little nuances, but generally a revocable trust is not asset protection. Other than protecting you from the government, it doesn't protect your assets, because you're the beneficiary. So just keep that in mind.
So if you're curious about asset protection with trust, go back to episode 127. We unpack that a lot. I want to stay on the trust train here and continue fleshing this out.
Okay, so I have a question, burning question. So I'm a motivated pilot. I say, that Adam guy sounds pretty smart. I give him a call. He sets up my trust. I tell him everything that I want to know about with my kids and all these things. Then Adam says to me, all right, Ryan, now you got to go out and you got to put everything and direct it to your trust.
It's exactly what I wanted to get into. Yes.
Okay. All right. But I have some.
Yeah. How do you put everything in?
So I want to get to two things I want to get to. One, putting everything in. And then two, when 5 years goes by and you grow older and your kids get more annoying or less annoying, or you love them more or love them less. I'm just joking. Right. Things happen, right? So like life changes. So then what do? Do I call Adam back up and do I redo everything? Does that cost more money? Is it by the hour? Like, you know what I'm saying? So how, cause like, this isn't just a one and done. This is probably going to be something that you work on from time to time.
Exactly. So and putting stuff into the trust, the very, like in our trust that we do, and a little plug for our legal department, I think we do just about more trust work than probably any other law firm in the country when it comes to doing these trusts. We have the best software, and the very first part of that is a tab that says your trust abstract or certificate of trust. It's a 3-page document that says the trust exists and that me and my wife are the trustees. So that 3-page document, I had a quitclaim deed, for example, for my primary residence. We drafted up a quitclaim deed to convey moving the property from me and my wife's name into the name of our trust. We give them that 3-page document, and now the primary residence is titled in the name of our trust. That's simple. For your personal checking account and savings account, I take that 3-page document. I walked into my bank and I said, hey, I would like to add my trust to the account. And the branch manager said, would you like to have new checks with your trust name? I said, no, thank you. Leave my checks alone. They're just Adam and Claudia. But the statements come, and my trust is the Legacy 6 Dynasty Trust. I'll come back to that in a minute. But now my checking account and savings account are titled in the name of my trust. Same thing with your, if you have any brokerage accounts or life insurance policies or retirement accounts, if I die, it goes to my wife. If she dies, it goes to me. If we both die, it goes to our trust. So I just called up my brokerage firm with my retirement account, said I'd like to add my trust as a successor beneficiary behind my wife. And I sent them that 3-page document, and there it is. Inside the trust, there is a schedule of assets. And there's, if you're married, you're going to have 3 pages, your assets, your spouse's assets, and your marital assets. So if you opened up a new brokerage account, for example, and I put that in the name of my trust, well, then I'm going to go open up my schedule and add that appropriately to my schedule of assets. So the schedule of assets, whether you write it in or type it in, does not matter, but I want to keep that up to date. I talked earlier about having the pour over will that said anything I forgot to put in the trust will go in the trust when I die. It's not quite that easy. It's not like it automatically happens. There's stuff behind that, but we don't have to go through probate, which is a big deal. But what I do is I want to have a nice little tidy list of bank accounts, brokerage accounts, properties I own, LLCs I have, life insurance and retirement accounts, just in case something happens on date night. I want to make sure that my trustee, my best friend is my trustee. He's very wise financially. I want to make sure that he's not spending the next 2 years trying to figure out what the heck I had and where it was located. So I've taken the time to write down my full account numbers, the phone number to call, if there's any contact people that he needs to know about. I just put that in my schedule of assets. If I sell it or close an account, I just open that up and cross it off. I buy something new, I add it back in. So that should always be done, keeping that up to date. That costs nothing. If you're making major changes where all of a sudden, my best friend is no longer my best friend, or something happens where I want to change that, generally, like our law firm, we charge $300 to $500 for any major changes. Or if you have another child and I've got to go add beneficiaries, generally it's $300 to $500 to make these changes or updates. There are some things that we do would cost nothing. If it does not take a lot of time, we'll make the change without any fees whatsoever. But that does need to keep, it's not just a one and done and never have to think about it again. You should keep that up to date. So at minimum, if your trigger is getting taxes done equals time to review my trust, then make that part of your regime. When you get your taxes done, let's just double check and make sure if there's anything I forgot to put in or sold that I need to cross off,
right,
is for my wife and kids. So that's how I look at it.
Excellent.
Well, I know Tate is dying to get into this thing, but I just have to say, how do you guys handle AIDS?
How we handle what?
What?
Aviation-induced divorce syndrome.
So and the way I was going to attack this, because Ryan and I wanted to end on the exact same topic here, and that is divorce. So there are a lot of pilots out there.
Domestic reorganizations.
Yeah, yeah. pilots are famous for divorce. We've all flown with, those captains who are on their third or fourth marriage, either with a prenup or without. And there's definitely some people listening here talking about putting all your assets into one big basket that might be saying, well, no, that sounds scary. So Adam, talk through the difference between a prenuptial agreement and a trust, and how those things actually kind of mirror each other? And then what happens during divorce?
Yeah, great question. Great thing to talk about. So I just got off the phone right before our podcast. I was on the phone with a dentist. He's a single guy in California and has a great dental practice, and he is going to be getting married. And I reminded him, I said, of course, you should do the prenuptial agreement, but oftentimes a prenuptial agreement doesn't work. There's ways that they can get around it. I said, the trust that you have, remember, marriage is a contract between you and your spouse. A trust is a contract between you and your beneficiaries. The marital contract does not supersede your premarital contracts. So once we get his revocable trust done, this will always be his premarital assets. Once he gets married, we will do another trust that will be marital assets. So I think it is very, very wise for anyone that if you're not married yet, get your revocable trust done. Now that will have all your premarital assets. Of course, it's always a good idea. Additionally, do a prenuptial agreement as well. But that's going to do, that's the best we can do to protect your stuff in the event of a divorce. And then I always keep that premarital trust separate. And I hope if you get married that you'll be married forever. I hope that happens. But statistically speaking, chances are 50-50 shot, it will end in divorce. So keeping these things in place is just a small investment now to protect your future is how I look at it.
So if I'm a pilot and I'm already married, and let's say, you know, you've been married for 20 years, don't have a prenup, you got kids, and you're putting all these assets into this basket. How do you think through, okay, what's my estate, what's my wife's estate, and what's our joint estate? Is that something that's outlined in the trust?
Yeah, you can absolutely in your trust. Remember, we've got those three schedules, your assets, your spouse's assets, and your marital assets. So if there's anything that you want to put in that trust as sole and separate property, that's something I always say. Let my legal department know when you put stuff in. We want that to be sole and separate property so that we can make sure that that goes under your schedule. Or even if you didn't get divorced, you die and you want to make sure that your wife, for example, is taken care of until she dies. But if she remarried, I don't want to have her spouse come in and mess with this stuff. So in your marital trust, your portion becomes irrevocable upon your death. So that's also something that we think about. And I'm in the mode where I hope I die before my wife does. I love her to death, and I hope I die before her. But if I do die and at a young age, I want her to remarry, but I don't want her new significant other to be taking all my stuff. So those are things that we always think about when we're putting that estate plan together and making sure that we do it with that in mind. And that's always a conversation I like to have with the legal department when we're drafting it, to make sure you're taking those steps and doing those things.
This is a good nuance, because you said when you die, your portion becomes irrevocable. Can you talk through, because it's one trust when you and your spouse are both alive. How does that play out when one spouse passes away and one is still alive?
So if there's anything that I have in my trust as sole and separate property, that becomes irrevocable at that point. And I put in my trust, my wife can live in our house as long as she wants. If she wants to sell it, she could sell it and buy something new. But unless she's buying a new primary residence for her to live in by herself, not with her new spouse, that I want that to go to my kids. So that's a conversation. That's how we drafted it in my assets, because it's in my schedule. That's my stuff. Something people often don't think about is artwork, jewelry, family heirlooms. In my case, my mother-in-law passed away a few years ago, and her husband didn't even think about it. Gave all the jewelry and gave it to my wife's brother. Haven't talked to the guy in 5 years because my wife wants that damn wedding ring. In her culture, it's something that the daughter gets the wedding ring, but the dad gave it to the brother. It's not even worth any money. I wish they would have outlined that in the trust. I wish they would have put stuff like that in there as well. So these are things that you can put in your schedule as family heirlooms and art or jewelry or things of that nature that don't have a quote-unquote title. I can still list those in our schedule and what our wishes are.
Last nuanced question here, and that is, you say that your primary residence happens to be in your schedule of assets in your trust. What about the way that you title that asset in order, like how the deed is recorded? So if you're both on title, Does it still, can it still go on your schedule? Do those two things need to match?
Yeah, that, so my trust, my title of the house is on title with the county is the trust. That's it.
Right.
So what's behind that trust, that's a private document. So no one on public record, no one knows what's behind that trust, which brings up another good point I'll talk about in a minute, is the naming of the trust. But the title for the primary residence, I have that listed in our schedule. It's a marital asset. And again, we've talked with it. And upon my death, I just want to make sure that my stuff that should be going to my kids goes to my kids and not to some Yahoo guy that right. comes in and rides my wife's coattails or something, right? I don't know if you guys have about that, but I am.
That question about titling brings us full circle to moving the assets into the trust, right? So, of course, the house is in the name of the trust because you did a quit claim deed and moved the house into the name of the trust, and then the trust outlines, you know, whose it is.
Correct. And that, and the, technically the house is in my marital schedule of assets because it is a marital asset. So, you know, technically if I die and my wife wanted to sell the house and take the money herself, technically she could, but I do have my wishes in there.
Excellent.
So, and because my house is a marital asset, I can only do is put wishes and that's it.
Makes sense. Yeah. Let's end on this. You said naming brings you to the naming,
yep.
right? So should people be naming this the Tate Duryea and Lucy Trust? Should they be that on the nose about it? Or should they be, I don't know. What's a funny thing to name you, Tate? What would the name your trust? What should be a hidden name that no one knows about? Or should it be recognizable?
So my advice always is do not put your name in the name of the trust. Do not call it revocable living trust or family trust. Mine is the Legacy 6 Dynasty Trust. And I strategically use the word dynasty trust because there is going to be like your primary residence, your personal checking account, savings account, your personal brokerage account is going to be titled in that trust name. And we really just want you in a position where if a lawyer does a preliminary asset search to see what you have, and your name is on the name of that trust and your house is in there, and that's a pretty nice house. Oh, yeah, we'll take that case for free. I've seen that happen all the time. So my guidance is call your trust whatever you want. Do not call it your name. Do not call it revocable trust or family trust. I was doing a training with this attorney. He's like, if you had a billion-dollar estate, this is the guy that you would hire. And I went through a training class with him. He said, and the training class was getting inside the mind of the judgment creditor's attorney. So the person is suing you, get inside the mind of that attorney that's suing you. And he said, not many attorneys out there think that a revocable trust provides any protection. They know that you are the trustee and beneficiary while you're alive. There is a small percentage of attorneys that see revocable trust and they're just not educated and they think they can't get it. But most of them know this. But those lawyers also know that, for example, a dynasty trust, it is a type of trust. It is a multi-generational irrevocable dynasty trust. So even though my trust is in fact a revocable living trust, you got to call it something. Let's call it something good.
Okay, so probably over 1,000 people listening to this have just said, "Oh crap, it's in my name."
Exactly.
So what's their next step?
Yep.
How do they change their name?
Yeah, it depends on how long they've had that trust.
And 5 years.
Yeah. 5 years, if it needs to be updated, you got two options. Either reach out to me, we'll form a new one, make sure it's all done right, and don't put your name in it. Retitle your house in the name of your trust, just record a new quick claim deed, update that, update your bank with your new trust information. Or go back to the law firm that drafted it and just say, hey, guys, I want to change the name of that trust. I called it, the Adam and Claudia Kente Trust, and I want to change it to something else. And generally, you can pay them $500 for just about anything, and they'll update the name of the trust. So one of those two things need to happen if you want to change your name of that trust.
Love it.
And the key here, just so everybody understands, it's not that you're creating an irrevocable trust. It's just that you're naming your family revocable living trust something that sounds like it's a multi-generational irrevocable trust to dissuade attorneys from going after it. To encourage attorneys not to take the case. They look at it, they look at the name, they go, that sounds irrevocable. Let's not even bother.
Truly a smokescreen. Because if I get brought into a deposition, I got to disclose that I'm the beneficiary of it. That's why I say it's not providing me any asset protection. But when they do their initial search and they're trying to figure out if they should take the case or not, that's where I don't want them to find anything. I want to minimize the target on my back. So that's the whole point of not calling it your name.
Love it.
Adam, how do people get in touch with you? I know you're going to be fielding a lot of calls from this. I'm personally working with you. You know, I'm not trying to necessarily promote you guys on the show, but I am going through this process with you, and it's been a pleasure. So thank you for your help with my personal situation. How can people get in touch?
Send me an email, adam@nchinc.com. And usually I'm back to you within 24 to 48 hours. If for any reason I don't get back to you within 24 to 48 hours, I am a human. I might miss something once in a while, but send me an email. I'll send over my calendar link and we can schedule a call and just see what you got going on. And, trust is a part of it. And I kind of think of that as a foundation for everything, but I'm here to help with any questions you have. If you have an LLC or you have a business or you have investments or whatever it may be, I'm an open book. I'm happy to share with you any questions you have about anything you already have going on. We're happy to talk about that too.
Always a pleasure. Love how you lay this stuff out. So thank you. We look forward to the next time talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Adam.
Take care.